my very special guest today, and I'm actually quite excited about this, John Morgan. He's an author who has been writing about the Princess Diana assassination. I mean, sorry, tragic accident. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. Yeah, thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about just who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, well, I'm an Australian, well, New Zealander, actually, but I've been living in Australia for about 20-odd years, and I've got taken an interest in the Princess Diana death. After the crash, I sort of thought things were a little bit odd, but I didn't really think too much about that. But then when Paul Burrell, her Diana's butler, he published a book in 2003, and in that book he had a handwritten letter that Diana had had written stating that she could die in a car crash. And so when I saw that, I sort of thought, well, that's interesting that she would actually know the way she was going to die. And so that was written in about 1995, and that's when I really took an interest in how it occurred. And then I actually came down with an illness. It was around about the same time as that, and so I had to retire from my work, and I ended up, once I came to terms with the illness, I ended up starting to write about the crash and what occurred.
Now, when I think I was still a boy when it happened, the world stopped that day, and everybody was just suddenly either glued to the television screen or they were glued to the front gates of Buckingham Palace laying flowers and weeping. It was such a huge, huge public event. And in my experience, whenever that happens, a public event of that size, it's usually some kind of false flag terrorism operation or some kind of intelligence agency-led assassination op or whatever. Otherwise, it just, you know, nobody would really care.
Yeah, well, she is a pretty popular, very, very popular person, the most photographed woman in the world. So there was a huge interest, but I think, at the time, there was a huge number of people. I think in the UK it was over 50%, and even today I still think it's around about 50% of the people believe she was assassinated. So, it was an incredible event, that's for sure, you know, and particularly for people over there. There was just a huge outpouring of affection for her after she died. But she was, even before she died, she was very well liked by people. And she was a person who, she was a humanitarian, and she cared about the people, which is sort of not really what you get in the normal royalty.
That's a no-no.
Sorry, my hearing's not too good. What was that?
That's a no-no.
A no-no, yeah, that's right. She was into sort of, like, she was the first person who made contact with someone who had AIDS without wearing gloves, sort of thing, and shook their hand, and first person of note, you know. And so she was sort of fearless like that, and at the time it was a thing where people, that, you know, we weren't really sure whether people with AIDS, whether it was contagious if you touched some sort of thing. And, you know, she was prepared to stretch that a bit. And then also her big thing the year before she died was she took on the anti-landmine cause, and she visited Angola first in January 97. That was 8 months before she died, and she walked in the landmine fields and that was all on TV at the time. I don't know if you remember that, but you said you were pretty young, I think. But you know, it's
I mean, I'm 27 now. I mean, what?
Yeah. Years? So, well, 15 years. You would have been 12 years, I think, 15 yeah. years ago. Yeah. So, you know, like I've got clear recollections of just seeing her on TV walking through those minefields. You know, and yeah, she was a brave woman, but she was a humanitarian. She cared about those landmine victims. You know, and that's why she got involved in it. And it had a huge impact, though, because on the nations that were involved in arms dealing, because, you know, like, she was moving to eradicate landmines, which obviously didn't go down too well for the governments of the US, France and UK and other nations, but primarily those are the three major arms dealing nations in the West. And so...
Well, hold on a second.
She was causing ructions. Yeah.
So we're talking about a princess who's the most photographed, photogenic, and in fact, I saw a photo of her yesterday. And in fact, we talked about her on the show. It might have been yesterday or the day before. And she looks every bit a princess, doesn't she? Okay. You look at her. You look at down to the clothes she wears, the smile on her face. She just looks like a princess.
Yeah.
And then you have a look at all these other royals and everything like that, and they look like, I don't know, mafioso gangsters who just look like they've been born in there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, she identified with people, you know, and that came across in her photos. I think it's sort of very photogenic and very caring person, you know. Like at the time, I didn't really see. I've never really been into royalty, so I sort of didn't really follow her when she was alive, you know. But I did notice these things. Like I said, I remember walking through the landmine fields, and I also remember when it came on the TV and she shook hands with the AIDS patient. Patient, you know, that was a major thing at the time, and. So there's the various aspects like that that you remember, but I didn't really, you know, never really followed royalty, and it was only the circumstances of the crash that got me really interested in her. And then when I studied into how she was, I was really quite surprised that she was so different.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that whenever you're in a high position and instead of acting like a scumbag, ripping people off, fronting for various charitable organizations that are doing anything but charity, that kind of thing. If you do the right thing in those positions, you've got a lot to worry about. And I find that this is not entirely dissimilar from everybody. If you're working for McDonald's and you decide that somebody who's coming up to you is like 400 pounds, you say, hey, dude, maybe you should have some fresh fruit and vegetables, or some fresh squeezed carrot juice, or something like that. Man, this stuff's going to kill you.
Yeah.
Fired.
Yeah, won't go down too well. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, that's a bit like that, really. You know, because she was prepared to take on causes like even with the AIDS thing. The Queen told her that she didn't like what she was doing, you know, and she wanted her to get into more. Sort of acceptable causes, you know, and so, she was sort of prepared to walk a different path, and, you know, eventually that led to her death, you know, along with other things that went on, but that was certainly a huge... like she sort of showed up the rest of the royal family, you know, like she was a bit too popular, I suppose, and you know, there were a lot of different aspects. Yeah.
I mean, the thing about the Queen is I kind of think of her as sort of I don't know. Have you ever seen The Dark Crystal? You know, where you have the Skeksis who are like these big, scary looking, wrinkled, old, crusty bird creatures, like. You know, that kind of thing. In the Jim Henson puppet sense of the word, that's what I'm talking about. That's the connotation I get when I look at members of the royal family, the majority of the time. And the AIDS aspect was quite interesting because I had a look into it. I think basically there were five original outbreaks of AIDS in Africa, or I think it might have been three. I think, and they all occurred in South Africa. And they all occurred within 5 miles of three separate United States military bioweapons research labs. And when they cracked open the AIDS virus and they tested it on people, it bonds to very specific types of DNA, namely black DNA. If you're a black person, the virus is 50, I think it was like between 50 or 52 times more likely to actually attach and infect you. So I think maybe the Queen really didn't like the idea that Princess Diana was going out there and helping AIDS patients, seeing them as people, because, hey, the Queen and the royal family have been funding eugenics programs and have even been taking part in selective breeding themselves for quite some time, and they have very little concern for the rest of the world. And for all intents and purposes, as far as my research has led me to believe, they actively don't like black people one bit and want to have them killed off. So hence, don't go help those black people with the AIDS, Diana. Why don't you just go and front one of my charities where we'll give sterilizing vaccines for them for the next 50 years for free. We'll be really loving and caring and stuff like that. And we'll only give them hepatitis C once, all right? Thank you. Thank you, Diana. Otherwise, I'm going to pull a Slobodan Milosevic on you, pull a bright flash, and you're going to die in a tunnel. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinny and Expo show. John is my guest, John Morgan, I think, and you can get his book. John, where exactly can people get your book? It's on Amazon, isn't it?
The books are online on Amazon.com and on a lot of other sites as well, a lot of other bookshops on the internet, right around the world. So the books are called, it's a series of books called Diana Inquest, is the title of the series, and then I can go through the volumes if you like. The first volume...
Sure.
Yeah. The first volume is Diana Inquest, The Untold Story. It talks about the events that happened on the day of the crash, what happened in the hotel before the Mercedes left, and what happened inside the tunnel, what the witnesses all said. That's the first volume. The second volume is called Diana Inquest, How and Why Did Diana Die? And that's about the motives for her assassination, and also talks about her mistreatment in the ambulance, how it took 1 hour, 43 minutes, for the ambulance to arrive at the hospital from the time of the crash, and how she actually died 6 minutes after arrival in the hospital. And it shows how there's actual evidence showing that she was actually mistreated in the ambulance. And then part three is called Diana Inquest, The French Cover-Up, and that goes into how the autopsy of Henry Paul, the driver, who was said to be drunk by the authorities, the autopsy showed that he was drunk, whereas the witnesses in the hotel all said he was sober, and the CCTV footage in the hotel shows that he was sober, but the autopsy showed that he was drunk, and the book shows how they actually had two bodies in the autopsy room. They had two lots of samples, one lot of samples from the other body, which was a person who was drunk. They used those samples when they carried out the testing for the autopsy results. And then the samples from Henry Paul, which were kept separately, they were used later on when the DNA testing was done. So that's part three, is about called The French Cover-Up. And also goes into how the French were involved in covering up, how they cleaned out the tunnel. They sent cleaners into the tunnel within a few hours of the crash, and the tunnel was reopened by about 6 o'clock. And part four
the crime
is about, it's called Diana Inquest, the British cover-up, and that's about how the how the Queen got involved very, very soon after her death in controlling the body, having the body embalmed in France before the body was shipped over the same day to the UK, and then how the Queen's coroner, the Royal Coroner, took control of the body illegally. She wasn't a royal at the time she died. She was her royalty had been removed a year earlier at the time of her divorce, and the Royal Coroner took control, even though the coroner who should have taken control, which was in the area where she was to be buried, the control was taken off him, and the Royal Coroner took control and made sure her body ended up in St. James Palace on the Royal Territory. And so the part four is about how the British have covered up, basically relating to the actions of the royals in events after her death. And then part five, which is the latest volume, which is called Diana Inquest, Who Killed Princess Diana? And that is about the involvement of the MI6 and also CIA, but mainly about the involvement of MI6 in the assassination. It shows who was that senior officers of MI6 were brought into Paris in the days leading up to the crash, and it also it names them, and it also goes into the MI6 history of assassination, because at the inquest the MI6 officers all said that the MI6 doesn't assassinate people, never has, and this goes into a history of assassination showing all the MI6 assassinations that have occurred since it was set up. Well, not all of them, but the ones that were known about. And
Hold on, let me get this straight.
Yeah.
A bunch of trained killers with licenses to kill claim that they don't assassinate people, and they never have.
Yeah, that's what they claimed at the inquest.
Oh, my God!
They said, we've never assassinate people. And, we don't kill people sort of thing. Yeah, that was one of the main themes of the MI6 evidence, yeah. And also goes into the involvement of the royals, senior royals, and the Way Ahead group, which was set up by the Queen in 1992. That's an interesting story in itself, the Way Ahead group, because it was set up in November 1992, which is the same month that the Queen gave her Annus Horribilis speech, and
What's that speech called?
Annus Horribilis, where she said it was her horrible year, you know, like, and she said, this is my Annus Horribilis, and that was 1992. And that was the year that Diana had, that was the first year Diana really went public with the problems in the marriage and the problems she had dealing with the royals. And she did it through an author called Andrew Morton, and she supplied him with taped information that was given to him through a go-between. And based on that information, he wrote a book called Diana, Her True Story. And that was published in June 1992. And that caused major ructions with the royals, and the Queen was very upset about that, and Philip, and because it sort of went, it was sort of a revealing to the public of problems in the royal family that no one had ever done before, you know, so it was sort of groundbreaking stuff. And Diana got into trouble over that, and that led to the separation from Charles in December 92. So the Way Ahead group was set up in November, and the Way Ahead group is a meeting of the senior royals. They meet twice a year, and they discuss major issues facing the royal family. And And the interesting thing is that at the inquest, there were two private secretaries. They were the only royal personnel that were close to the Queen Philip that gave evidence. And they both said, one was the private secretary for the Queen, one was the private secretary for Philip, and they both insisted that the way he could only dealt with working out schedules and, you know, like making sure that everyone's engagements fit in with all the other royals. And yet you've got the Queen as the chairman of the Waihead Group and Philip and their children, the Queen's children, all attend, and their private secretaries and the Lord Chamberlain and a couple of other officials. And so, it's obvious just by the name of the group, the Waihead Group, obviously it's talking about the way ahead for the royal family, you know, but the, and you've got 15 years of media articles where information out of Waihead Group meetings has been leaked to the press, and all of those articles say the Waihead Group deals with major policy issues or major issues facing the royal family, and that's obvious, you know, but at the inquest, that wasn't the story they put out. They put out that the Waihead Group only deals with this sort of, you know, day-to-day scheduling, you know, making sure there's no stuff-ups in the scheduling. Now, that's a total lie. And so then you've got to ask yourself, well, why would they lie about that? I mean, it's obvious that they would have talked about Diana at the Waihead Group meetings, and there's no problem with that. They could have, the private secretaries could have said at the inquest, well, we do talk about Diana because she was a major issue facing the royal family. And everyone would have understood that because she was. You know, from 1992 onwards, Diana was a problem. But the fact that they lied about it, distanced themselves from that, and said, no, 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 we never talked about Diana at all during the Waihead Group meetings, well, obviously they're covering something up. So then you start thinking, well, what did they talk about at the meetings, you know? And there was a meeting that was held 39 days before Diana died, and it was actually brought forward. It was a meeting that was scheduled for September because they meet twice a year, once in January and once in September. And this meeting took place on July the 23rd, 1997, so it was brought forward. And then you've got to think, well, why would they bring it forward? And then when you look at what was going on at that time, what had happened was on June the 3rd, Mohammed Al-Fayed had invited Diana to a holiday at his villa in south of France with William and Harry, because Diana was looking at where to take the boys on the holiday. And so within a few days, she had agreed and she had accepted that invitation, and yet that obviously didn't go down well. Like you were saying, there's a racism element involved in the royals, and so where you've got a Muslim like Mohammed Al-Fayed, who was also, for various reasons, they didn't like him, you know, like
Wasn't he a former gun runner or something like that, and that's how he made his name?
No, not Muhammad, no. One of his relatives was a arms dealer, a guy called Khashoggi. He was a brother-in-law, actually. But
an arms dealer as in he worked for Halliburton and gave people depleted uranium poisoning, or an arms dealer like he's running an illegal gun-running mission?
No, I don't think illegal, no. Middle Eastern arms dealer. Yeah, but Muhammad wasn't involved in that side of it. What happened is Muhammad came to the UK and then eventually he bought Harrods. And I think that would cause the problem to start with, you know, that you'd have an Egyptian buying Harrods, you know. And then he was involved in the Cash for Questions scandal. I think it was Cash for Questions, yeah, in the UK where they had refused him citizenship over a long period, even though his children are British citizens, and they refused to give him Muhammad citizenship, you know. So he's a person that was really disliked, excuse me, by the royals, and so what Diana was doing was she was taking William, the future king, and Harry, his brother, into Mohammed's villa there in the south of France for about 10 days, and that, you know, like that on its own, that may not have been a huge thing, but when you look at it in the perspective of what had occurred, like I said about her publishing, her going off that book of Morton's in 1992 and providing him all that information, and then in 1995, 3 years later, she went on Panorama on nationwide TV on Panorama and spoke openly about the problems in their marriage with Charles and how the royals had mistreated her. And so there was a major documentary in the UK, Panorama, on the BBC, and that went to air in November 1995. And straight after that, within, I think, a couple of weeks, the Queen was organising for the divorce, you know, so that was her reaction to that. So when the divorce came through August 1996, a year before Diana died, once that divorce had gone through and the Queen stripped Diana of the HRH, the Royal Highness status, and basically she was removed from the royal family. She was outside of the royal family from then on. And basically the problem for the Queen was then, she created her own problem in a way, because she had put Diana outside of her control. There was no other legal thing that the Queen could do if Diana kept on playing up, you know what I mean? If she kept on speaking out in that, there's nothing. Once Diana was divorced outside of the royal family, the Queen had removed her ability to legally control her. And so that is really, when you look at that background, and then when you see what occurred in June, where Diana, excuse me, where Diana accepted this invitation to go to Mohammed's with the boys, Diana on her own would have been no problem. But taking William and Harry into Mohammed Al-Fayed's villa, what happened was the Wahid group meeting got brought forward from, once they knew about that, they brought forward the Wahid group meeting to...
John, we're coming to a break now, so we'll hold that thought, man. I really want to expand on this when we come back. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. If you want to keep us on the air, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, subscribe for $5 a month, or need a donation. We need that support now. We'll be right back after the break.
Yeah, I was just talking about the Way Ahead Group, which is the Royal Family's committee that deals with major policy and issues facing the royal family. And we were talking about in July 1997 how the Way Ahead Group meeting was brought forward. And what happened was, when you look at the dates of what occurred, where Diana took the two boys away on the holiday to Mohammed's villa in the south of France, and you look at the dates of the Way Ahead group meetings, there was actually a preparatory meeting held on July the 8th, which is another reason why you would see the purpose of Way Ahead group meetings as being much more than just... dealing with scheduling, which is what the private secretary said, because if you have a preparatory meeting, then you have a full meeting later, and which is what happened in July 1997. So, you know, if there was just dealing with scheduling, it would be dealt with by the private secretaries. You wouldn't have the Queen and Philip and that being there in the meetings. You would have the private secretaries discussing things, going back to their principals and working it out between themselves. So anyway, that's by the by. But what they did is on the July the 8th, 1997, there was a preparatory meeting of the Wahid group, and that was 3 days before Diana took the boys on a holiday. So the holiday started on July the 11th, and then the holiday finished on July the 20th, and then the Wahid group meeting occurred on July the 23rd. The main full meeting occurred on July the 23rd, which is 3 days after the boys were back at, this is up at Balmoral, where the Royals go for holidays at that time of the year. And so the boys were returned to, excuse me, returned to Balmoral on July the 20th, and the Waihe group meeting took place on July the 23rd. And actually, what it's interesting because on July the 20th there was an article in, I think it was the Sunday Mirror in the UK, where they were talking about the upcoming Waihe group meeting, and they said Diana will be top of the agenda. So there was a leak to the media from someone in the royal household that told this reporter that Diana would be top of the agenda. But it basically ties in with the holiday that she took the boys on, which would have been a huge issue for the Royals, taking the future king.
So let me get this straight. They held a meeting where they discussed her when they knew that she wouldn't be there and she'd be away on holiday?
No. Diana wasn't invited to any of these meetings because Diana was outside of the royal family at the stage. After the divorce in August 96, Diana was removed from the royal family. So she was a free spirit, if you know what I mean, sort of to coin a phrase.
She was considered the princess and the royal by much of the public, though, anyway, wasn't she?
Seen as a royal? Yeah, well, I suppose, but the reality was that Queen had removed her Royal Highness status and, she was, I suppose people still looked on her as a royal. I mean, she had been since 1981, so 16 years or 15 years as a royal, but she actually was removed. And so she wasn't part of the Waihe group meetings. But the Waihe group meetings, I think even from 1992, I doubt Diana was in any Waihe group meetings. Once the separation had taken place, and also once she had gone public with that book 6 months before the separation, basically she was a rebel. She was a rebel. She was an independent person, and she was speaking her mind sort of publicly. Well, that didn't go down well, and basically the Queen didn't want to have much to do with her after that. So, but when you get back to this Waihe group meeting, it took place, the preparatory meeting took place 3 days before the holiday, and then the actual full meeting took place 3 days after the holiday. So the boys were back, the holiday was over, they could assess what had occurred, you know, and assess the media reaction. There was a lot of media criticism of Diana taking the boys to Mohammed's. That was a huge issue at the time in the media in the UK. And anyway, I think basically, like I said, Diana was outside of the Queen's control at that stage. And so up until the divorce, the Queen had been able to legally deal with Diana if she did anything. But once the divorce was settled, she was outside the royal family, there was no longer any legal avenue for the Queen. She couldn't control Diana. She was free to do, once she was divorce was over, she was free to act as a citizen, you know. And
you know what's funny? This reminds me of the King Henry VIII thing when he gets excommunicated from the church. And he's like, well, I'll just make my own church. I'm free.
Absolutely. It is like that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you get it. That's what the situation was. And so that, I don't know if the Queen had sort of taken it that far to realise what was going to happen, you know. But obviously,
she may have
Diana was going to operate more as a free
really
spirit.
Offended. Do you think that the Queen might be a bit sensitive sometimes when her rule or her orders are questioned or her will is disobeyed?
Sorry, I couldn't hear the full question. What was it?
Do you think that the Queen might have some kind of... You know how some people, they are very nice and friendly and lovely and what have you, But if you cross them, disobey them, or subvert their will, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, well, that's right. And she would be like, see, it's sort of, when you think about it, she's in a very unique position because she's actually a very powerful woman. Like every week she meets with the Prime Minister, you know, of the UK, and they don't talk about the weather. They're talking about what's going on, you know, and that's every week. So, and even if the Prime Minister's out of the country or the Queen's out of the country, the Prime Minister has to ring her. So there's that contact. Every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. there's that contact between the Queen and the head of the UK political system, the Prime Minister. And so she's a very powerful woman. Now, we even see it like in, when you get like over here, John Howard, he was in power for 10 years or something. Well, they start getting arrogant. I think Helen Clark might have been similar over there. Once they've been in power for 10 years or so, these leaders start getting more and more arrogant. They get more and more sort of like the power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolute, this sort of thing. Well, the Queen's been in there for 60 years, you know. So she's used to being the top dog, you know, and she's been that person for all that time. And the Prime Minister has to kowtow to it. And if she asks the Prime Minister questions in these meetings, he's got to answer them, you know. And every bill that goes through Parliament crosses her desk, and she doesn't just sign them. She's reading them. She's aware of what's going on in the nation, you know. She's fully involved in the running of the Commonwealth. And I think you're right. I think, you know, well, what's Diana got to, what right has she got to cross the Queen, you know? And
now,
what right has
point.
She got to speak publicly about what's going on in the Royal Family when no one else has? Sort of
more
thing,
to the point,
you know, so
here's another thing I want to know.
Yeah.
What did Diana know that they didn't want her to tell? What had Diana done that they saw was such a threat that they couldn't leave her alive?
Yeah, well, I think it was more what she was going to do. You know, like, see, when you're looking at it, it wasn't just the Queen that wanted to get rid of Diana. It was Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and the leader of France at the time, Jacques Chirac. These guys saw a problem because she was prepared to destroy the arms dealing of these nations. You know, she wasn't going to stop at landmines. She would have gone on to other weapons, and so that was an issue for them. Now, they don't. Clinton and Chirac obviously don't talk to the Queen, but Blair does. So Clinton and Chirac talk to Blair, and Blair talks to the Queen. So you had, you've got these.
Sorry, John, you'll have to hold that thought there.
Yeah, okay.
We'll come back right after the break. We have another hour with John. John, would you like to take some callers?
Yeah, I'm happy to speak to callers, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, call on in. The number is 218-339-8525. If you were, where were you on that day? I think I was at home watching television on a Sunday night, 12 years old, or what have you, you know? It was just like another day. Oh, my God, somebody famous died. How amazing, how extraordinary. And of course, being 12 years old and not knowing any of the background, had no idea what was really going on. Much like a lot of people, but a lot of people really loved it. And it seems that when you really love somebody, when they get killed, you become a bit suspicious as to why. We'll be right back.
The reasons that she would have been assassinated, and, you know, like I said, well, it's more what she was going to do, but she'd already done a lot, you know, but what happened was after the holiday when she took the boys to Muhammad's, then immediately after that the relationship with Dodi developed. So even in those 3 days between the holiday in the south of France and the Way Ahead group meeting that actually took place on July the 23rd, even in those 3 days that relationship with Dodi was starting, and she was under surveillance by MI6, and so that information about the developing relationship even would have been known to the Royals. Plus, you know, William and Harry had been there when Diana and Dodie met as well at the villa. So you sort of the relationship of Dodie developed, and Diana even before that was planning to move to the US. So she would have been getting even further out of the Queen's orbit, more out of control, you know. So there was a build-up of factors there, and with the Diana-Dodie relationship, of course, you've got the potential for a Muslim to be the stepfather to the king, which is basically not acceptable as well. So that's a reason why she would be assassinated. That relationship was really moving quite quickly, actually, and there was an engagement ring that was purchased. They were about to get engaged. That's what the evidence points to, that when Diana died, they were about to get engaged, and so that would have been a pressure, the building pressure as well, you know. But when you're looking at the motives, it's, you know, I think the decision was made that she would be removed, assassinated. That decision was made somewhere in that late July area, so about a month before she actually died, around that group meeting.
So they had a month to set up the op, basically.
Yeah, except that it was quite complicated because, see, this is the thing with MI6 and intelligence agencies. With someone like Diana, the assassination had to be something extremely deniable, you know, because she was so popular that you do not want any link with intelligence causing it. And you can't get anything more deniable than a car crash. I mean, you've got 3,300 people a day dying in car crashes around the world. So you get a car accident, the first thing that jumps to people's mind is that's an accident, you know, and it's the most deniable thing, really. And so that's what their criteria is. It has to be deniable. And
now,
so to plan that... Sorry?
There was also a plot by, I think it might have been MI6 or MI5, that was revealed just before the Kosovo and Yugoslavian wars, when Slobodan Milosevic was allegedly attacking Kosovo. And they said that the way that they were going to assassinate him was in one of the tunnels in Serbia. I forget what the name of the tunnel was called, but the plan was to come up alongside the tunnel, alongside his presidential motorcade or whatever, in the tunnel, and emit a. They have this bright flashing device that emits this huge, kind of like a flashbang grenade, in terms of brightness, and it's directional, so you can blind the driver. And when drivers become blind, obviously, they're going to crash, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that's what happened in the Diana case. But when you're talking about the planning, you know, it's not easy, because you've got to know they're going to going through that tunnel. Like, you sort of... So what happened in this case was that the knowledge that they were even going to be in Paris, that was known about the 18th of August. So you're talking 13 days before the crash is when they actually knew that Diana and Dodie would be coming to Paris at the end of August. And so they basically had 13 days to get this together. And when you look at the tunnel, the issue there is that Dodie had an apartment. He lived in an apartment in Paris, and the Ritz Hotel was owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed. And Diana and Dodie had already been to Paris. They went there on the July the 26th, 27th weekend. And on that weekend, they'd travelled between the apartment and the hotel. So what the intelligence was banking on was that there would be a trip between the hotel and the apartment. and preferably late at night. And that's what did occur, and that was a fair bet. I mean, you sort of, they own both places, and they'd be travelling between the two. That's quite logical, really. So the tunnel is actually not on the route, but it's right very close to the route. And what it entailed was that there was an expressway that they would go down that, as part of the route, and then there was an exit that would be, there was one exit that where the car would go to, if it was going to Dodie's apartment from the hotel. And all they had to do was have a motorbike there that prevented the car from turning off at that exit. And that's what occurred on the night. They were pursued by several motorbikes, several powerful motorbikes. And people think there was the paparazzi, but that's not true because the paparazzi were riding scooters and they were in small cars. And they weren't riding the sort of motorbikes that the witnesses saw. Witnesses saw up to five motorbikes. Some saw three, some saw five, some saw two, I think. But mainly it was three to four, basically, motorbikes that were surrounding the store, pursuing the Mercedes. And there was no backup car, which was part of the plan. It was a very, very complicated operation. And
sounds very JFK, like JFK assassination. You see all of a sudden all the bodyguards and everybody who's paid to protect them, they just suddenly kind of, they go back for some reason. And some of the footage, like when they were coming out of the airport, for example, there's supposed to be agents riding on the back of the car. And one guy came over and he told that guy, "No, get off the back of the car, mate. Stand back, you know, way back." And he's like, "What? What's going on here?" There's this confusion, and it just goes to show you, there's no protection from an inside job. So part of the security team might have been on the take, do you think?
Sorry, the security?
Do you think that they may have been on the take of the Royals or the intelligence agencies to set them up or something?
Yeah, well, the Royals weren't really involved in what occurred on the, you know, in Paris. All the Royals had to do was give the nod to the MI6, and that occurred around the time of that way head group meeting. And then, there was a security, definitely security was part of the issue, like no backup car. All day they had been driving with the Mercedes and a backup car. But there was a plan at the hotel two agents. There were two agents who were working with MI6. Henry Poole was one of them. He was the driver. Obviously, he didn't know he was going to die. This is the thing with MI6 too. They don't. Everything's on a need to know. So each agent only understands what they need to know. Like Henry Poole actually drove to his own death. Well, he didn't know that. He probably thought he was trying to improve things for them, you know, but trying to protect Diana and Dodie. But the two agents in the hotel, they were involved in, it was an elaborate, decoy plan. They had the main car and the backup car were out the front of the hotel, but they came up with a new plan that they would use a third car. Which had been sitting in a car park for a few hours. They used a third car out the back of the hotel with no backup. And so the bodyguards weren't happy with the plan, but they went along with it because that was what Henry Poole...
That's why they're bodyguards. That's why they're bodyguards. They follow orders.
That's right. That's right. And so anyway, they ended up with one bodyguard in the car.
Before we continue... You were talking about how they had an escort following them around the whole time. Whenever there's an assassination, the first thing you look for is breaches of SOP, Standard Operating Procedure. If Standard Operating Procedure is not followed, then there's somebody working on the inside.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And that's what happened here. Things completely were changed. You know? And so you end up with the car on its own. It had these group of motorbikes pursuing it, not paparazzi. Paparazzi were way behind. By the time they got down the expressway, they left them way behind because they were riding, like I said, underpowered vehicles, scooters and small cars. So anyway, these powerful motorbikes were pushing things along. One of them got in front of the car and prevented it from taking the exit it should have taken. And then it was forced into the tunnel. And as you were saying, there was a powerful flash. What happened was there was a white Fiat Uno that was also part of the operation that was waiting in the tunnel, near the entrance to the tunnel, going really slowly waiting. And it was straddling the two lanes at the time the Mercedes came into the tunnel. And at the same time as that, one of the powerful motorbikes with a pillion on the back was overtaking. You've got to think it's in France, the right hand, they're driving on the right hand side, so you've got a motorbike overtaking on the left, overtaking the Mercedes on the left, and at the same time the white Fiat Uno is on the right, straddling the lanes, so the Mercedes driver had to choose between hitting the white Fiat Uno or the motorbike. The motorbike got in front of the Mercedes. The Mercedes sort of sideswiped the Fiat Uno, and then as the motorbike got in front, he had the flash. The pillion had the flash on the back. He was sitting on the back. He flashed the driver, and from that point, very very powerful flash we're talking about. And from that point, the driver lost control. And
The details after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, John Morgan is my guest from the Diana Inquest. Back to me.
So once the driver was flashed with the anti-personnel device, blinded, he just lost control, and he ended up crashing into the 13th pillar of the tunnel. And
what a coincidence.
Sorry?
What a coincidence with the numerology.
Yeah, that's right.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Because I had a question in from the chat room that that particular spot where she died was allegedly, like, once upon a time, an old place where people would be sacrificed or something. Do you have any evidence on that?
Yeah, I've heard about that. I've never really researched that, but yeah, I have seen that before. Yeah, I just think that might be a coincidence, but I don't think that was planned. I mean, they couldn't know exactly where the car would crash, but
as you said, what happened was these five bikes were chasing them, and you said that they forced them to take the wrong turn. So I think that they knew exactly where they were going to do the business. Because
they made sure that would happen.
Yeah. And of course, because they were capable of boxing the car in, you could have the lead person deciding when the flash would happen, and you could estimate pretty quickly that a crash would happen virtually instantly after that instance. So it's perfectly logical for me to suspect that MI6, who have the MI5 or whatever, their symbol of their agency is a big pyramid with an all-seeing eye at the top of it. And which suggests to me that there is an occult element to that intelligence agency that possesses secret or hidden knowledge of some kind, whether that be by history, locations, things of that nature. But you know, that's just my analysis.
It could be. Yeah, I've never studied that side of it, I was going to say that. That Diana, they couldn't know Diana would die, you know. That's the thing in a car crash, you can't tell. And what actually did happen was that when it crashed into the pillar, the two people on the driver's side died instantly. So you've got Henry Paul, the driver, Dodie was sitting behind them, both of them died instantly. And the two people on the passenger side survived. Trevor Rhys-Jones, the bodyguard, he's still alive today. Diana survived as well, and she was in the back. So anyway, The thing being that they actually, MI6 had it so well organized with the CIA, with the CIA help, and the French intelligence help as well, with DGSE, that they, the ambulance was organized, and they, and the two doctors that were running the ambulance that came to help Diana, they were part of it, and they, that their mistreatment, like taking 1 hour, 43 minutes to get to the hospital, and there's evidence of their mistreatment of Diana in the ambulance, which actually brought on her death. So she, had she been taken to a hospital in a normal situation, if she hadn't been Diana, if she'd just been an ordinary person taken to hospital, she would still be alive today, you know. So the crash did not kill Diana, and there's a lot of witness evidence of her talking, you know, in the back of the car, still alive, talking. In fact, the first doctor who gave her a what they call a Glasgow coma scale rating in the medical industry, they do this at crash sites, and she scored a 14 out of 15. So she was excuse me, she was cognizant, and basically, like at the inquest, the way the specialist put it was, she wasn't about to do the Times crossword, but she was pretty well up there, you know. And but by the time she got to hospital, an hour and 43 minutes later, and they'd finished off her in the ambulance, then 6 minutes later she died.
That so, sounds like a huge delay.
Oh, that's a an huge delay. It's just totally unbelievable, you know. And they, you know, you can tell when you look at the transcripts, which are all in part two, the book part two, the transcripts of what went on between the people in the ambulance and the guy at the ambulance control, who was not part of it, the person at SAMU control who was talking to them on the phone, he wasn't part of it. And he was saying, haven't you left the tunnel yet? Haven't you left the tunnel, you know? And they were saying, in 5 minutes, we'll leave in 5 minutes. Well, it took them, I don't know, it was a long time, up to an hour before they even left the tunnel, possibly even longer. And so they were just basically hanging on, you know, and they were filling her with these
drugs,
things to medication to increase the blood pressure. But what happens is if you do too much of that, if there's any internal injury, which there was an internal injury, you increase the blood pressure and you've got a torn vein, which there was, and they knew there was a thoracic trauma, so they knew there'd be a fair chance of a torn vein or something like that. Then increasing the blood pressure, of course, increases the pressure on the torn vein, and so that helped to bring about her death. And you know, the other thing is that in the transcripts, the you've actually got a doctor there in the ambulance saying nothing for the thoracic to the SAMU base, the ambulance base, and it was quite the opposite. That when you look at the records, it shows they did know there was thoracic trauma, but he said
nothing. Who was that doctor? Who was that doctor? Who? How many people were in this ambulance? What were their job positions?
Well, it's an interesting number of people in the ambulance. There was about five people all up. There was a driver.
Why do you need five people in an ambulance? That's overcrowding, isn't it?
I know. That's on top of Diana, I think. So you've got the driver who was named. You've got the doctor Martino, who was one of the people that helped to bring about her death. And there was another doctor called Arno De Rossi. He wasn't named, just being in the ambulance. And there was also two other people. No, hang on. There was one other person who was a trainee who was there in the ambulance. So how many is that? That's three, four. That's four plus Diana. Maybe it's four plus Diana. Anyway, that person who was...
Can I ask? How many of those half a dozen people are still alive? How many of those half a dozen people in the ambulance, including Diana, are still alive?
Still alive? Yeah, well, Diana's the only one that's dead, as far as I know. But the thing is that the way when you look at the transcripts and what they've said, I mean, fancy a doctor saying nothing for the thoracic. They don't say that sort of thing. What they do is they try and get the specialist there in the hospital for what's needed. Now, they knew there was a thoracic trauma. and he actually specifically said nothing for the thoracic. And that meant that at the hospital there would be no specialist, no thoracic specialist waiting when that ambulance arrived, because it was the middle of the night. And that's what occurred, but it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because by the time she got to the hospital, they had virtually killed her, you know. But there was other evidence, like the ambulance stopped, actually stopped for 5 minutes, about less than half a kilometre from the hospital. And you've got two journalists outside on the other side of the road, and they're watching, because they followed the ambulance. And one of them said, they might have both said, the ambulance was rocking. Now, and they also saw a doctor get out of the front passenger seat, so, and he went into the back. So there was already a doctor in the back. Another doctor came out of the front passenger seat and went into the back. So they had to, by the time that ambulance stopped, they had two doctors in the back, plus the assistant. So that's three. I thought there was another assistant, actually. So there was at least three, anyway, people with Diana in the back of that ambulance while it was stationary, and he saw it rocking. So, you know, that no one knows exactly what happened at that point, but why would the ambulance be rocking? At the inquest, the doctor said, all we did when they stopped was we just increased her her drip. Well, you know, it just doesn't add up. When you look at the evidence for the doctor who was cross-examined at the inquest and what he actually says, and then his statement, there's conflict between a statement that was given to the French police after the crash and what he said at the inquest as well. So there's a lot of things that don't add up. And one of the biggest things that doesn't add up is when the inquest was carried out by Lord Justice Scott Baker, the jury were prevented from hearing the statements of the witnesses that were taken sort of straight after the crash. What happened was the judge said, look, you've just got to rely on the evidence that you hear in court. Now, the evidence they were hearing in court was a cross-examination of a witness 10 years after the crash. So you might get a witness who was right there, saw what happened in the tunnel on the night, is cross-examined at the inquest 10 years later, going on a memory of what occurred 10 years earlier. They had a statement there taken by the French police within hours of the crash, interviewing that witness, getting their statement, and the jury were not allowed to have that statement. Now, once that jury realised what was going on, 2 months into the inquest, the jury realised, well, what the hell's going on here? We can't work out what's going on unless we see those statements that were given straight after. And the judge said, no, you cannot have those statements. You have to rely on what you hear in court. It's just unbelievable, because those witness statements taken straight after the crash, those are the most valuable documents, you know, and the jury weren't allowed to see them. There's another book, actually, which I didn't mention, which is called Diana Inquest, The Documents the Jury Never Saw. And those are documents that were provided to me. After I'd done two or three volumes of this case, there was a person who took an interest who from within the British police investigation, and they actually sent me a disc of documents that the jury never saw. And so I published those. And they're very critical documents. When you look at the documents in that book, the inquest was into the deaths of Diana and Dodie, and yet the jury never saw the post-mortem of Diana and never saw the toxicology report on the samples taken from her body. We're investigating the death of a person, and the critical documents to establish cause of death are the post-mortem. That's what you do a post-mortem for. And yet the jury never got to see the post-mortem of Diana, never saw the toxicology report, you know. That's part of what is in part four. It shows that there's quite a lot of evidence showing that the samples that were tested that were meant to be Diana's were actually taken from another woman's body. This is in the UK, that the samples tested were different. And that probably relates to the Queen taking control, didn't want any scandal if there was a pregnancy that would come up on any testing, so just got her samples sort of shoved aside and they used samples from someone else. You know, so, but the thing is that the jury would have been aware of that if they had had access to the toxicology report, because the toxicology report showed that the sample, the blood sample tested, didn't have any embalming fluid in it, you see, whereas Diana was embalmed in France before she got to the UK. So when the post-mortem was done in the UK, they were doing a post-mortem on a body that had been embalmed, so the blood would have had embalming fluid in it. But when you look at the toxicology report, which Jury never saw, that there's no embalming fluid, and the toxicologist was really surprised at that, because she didn't know. She just was working on the sample she was given. And she did her own research into, is it possible to have a blood sample where a person's been embalmed and not have embalming fluid showing up in the sample? So even the toxicologist wasn't in on what was happening, you know. And so there's just so many issues with this crash, you know. And the biggest thing being that the jury were prevented from seeing so much information. It's so you're never going to get an inquest where the jury were actually on a level playing field.
Well, this is why when if a government wants to cover something up, they appoint an inquest or they say, we'll wait till all the facts come out in court. And surprise, surprise, the judge who's presiding over that court will be on the take, and he'll make sure that any relevant evidence that would actually contradict the official line is not admitted. And anybody who talks about it, that kind of thing, hey, they could be held in contempt. It's a great way to hold a conspiracy together. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. John Morgan is my guest. We'll be right back after the break. My very special guest, John Morgan. We're talking about the Diana inquest. So what did you think about my last statement there, John, about how whenever they want to cover something up, they just basically say, oh, all the details will come out in court. And surprise, surprise, they control the judge, and the judge doesn't allow the evidence to come out in court.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened, you know. And that was the thing. One of the issues, too, is that it was delayed for so long, you know, like, you're talking 10 years. So I think that in the case of Diana, there was a lot of interest, you know, like, because she was so famous, so well-known and so liked by people, there was a lot of interest. But the thing is that if you leave it for 10 years, then the interest wanes. And they must know that. They must know, well, 10 years, the public sort of... the public interest reduces as time goes on, and so they must have thought, well, we'll leave it for 10 years and it's easier to be able to do it how we want to do it, sort of thing, and that's what occurred. It's really quite dreadful. It's a shocking injustice, you know, and so that's one of the reasons I'm writing the books, is to try and help right the injustice that's occurred.
And giving the info out to the people. So let's think about the injustice and how to actually correct this mistake. What do you think might be done in order to get this out to the public? I mean, do you think maybe some private prosecutions might be filed against the royal family or the intelligence agencies? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think at the moment Mohammed Al Fayed's trying to do court. Get justice in France. I think it's all very hard. I think that because France, the UK, the US are involved, so you're not really going to get justice there. I think it has to go to the International Court of Justice.
That's all globalist control anyway.
Sorry, what was that?
That's all globalist-controlled court system
Yeah, well, that's right. But I just don't know how you get justice, you know. How do you get justice in a case like this? It might be impossible.
He's
doing the best he can do. Like, he's trying to pursue it in France, and, you know, you never know. Something can happen. But you have to get sort of honest judges. And I can see in the case of the inquest, it was set up so the judge was corrupt, and there was no hope of any justice right from the start. So I think probably the best thing that can happen is that people get to know, you know, what occurred, and that's one of the reasons for writing these books, that does help publicise it, you know, and the more people know, they say truth sort of frees you, you know, so knowledge is a sort of freeing thing, and it does help people understand what occurred, and I think that it's just a question of people, the only justice can be that people know, you know, what occurred.
That's what I was about to say, John, is that the information is concealed, and it's concealed because it's damaging to the government. Right? When people know about this, here's the trust principles that they learn in school. Trust your government, trust your monarchy, your intelligence agencies are there to serve you. And there's many, many cases that you could look at that have occurred in Britain and France and Germany or the US or whatever that connote the involvement of those agencies. You've been taught in public school all your life are there to protect you and do the right thing. So I think that if we can wholesale shatter people's confidence in their governments, which lie to them and subvert the course of justice, they won't be able to pull off this kind of stuff again. I think maybe that's the best thing that we can do, is if enough people know, it means that their game plan is exposed and they won't be able to pull the same tricks again, at least.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's probably what it boils down to. That's right, I think. Yeah, it's a question of... And I think the internet's helped in that, that, you know, it helps with the proliferation of knowledge. And, you know... Yeah, it's just a question of knowledge, isn't it? You know, like people need to know this sort of thing, and the more that it gets out, the more likely you are that there's going to be some justice here.
The two things that I found was most interesting about the Diana inquest, I'm not sure if you can corroborate these, but firstly, the favourite piece of factoid was the security cameras along the route that they travelled. There were 14 of them. On that night, every single one of them failed simultaneously. Oh, my God, that can't happen statistically. It's impossible. Well, virtually impossible. And the other was that the paparazzo, who was allegedly the one following them, was found burnt to death in his car, and it was ruled a suicide. This is the first time in the history of Europe ever that somebody allegedly committed suicide by burning themselves to death in a car.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. James Anderson, he's an interesting one, actually. He was following Diana, and he looked on the... he actually wrote a report on his on the holiday Diana had taken just before the crash, and he said in that report that it was the biggest thing in 50 years, as media was, you know, in France, and so he was quite a huge follower of Diana. And anyway, he came home early. He came home on the 27th, whereas the holiday didn't finish till the 30th. And then he was the owner of the Fiat Uno that was in the tunnel. So he had links to intelligence, and and the witnesses who, from their French statements, the witnesses who saw the Fiat Uno and saw the driver, and there were two or three that saw the driver, that their descriptions fit James Anderson. So it's very likely that he was, in fact, he bragged to people after the crash that he had been in the tunnel on the night of the crash. So he was that guy driving the Fiat Uno, and yeah, like you say, in 2000, his car that he was in was incinerated in a farmyard in the south of France. So totally incinerated, beyond recognition, and they did try and put it down to suicide, but the one of the firemen who arrived at the scene said that there were a couple of bullet holes in his head. So you know, if you commit suicide you might get one bullet hole, but you wouldn't get two, you know. But I think there's evidence pointing to it not being suicide. I haven't sort of researched that as deeply as I would have liked, but I sort of, you know, the subject is so big, you know, that you have to, I've already written several volumes, and, you know, you have to sort of draw lines at certain points and say, well, I can sort of keep it focused on what happened in the tunnel as much as I can, you know. But oh, there's definitely question marks over the way he died. There's no doubt about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way the autopsy was carried out, you know. And the people that people doing these autopsies, you know, like in the UK as well as in France, the autopsies are so important to establishing cause of death. But if you've got a crooked person doing the autopsy, then you're going to get crooked results. And that's where they were able to say it was a drunk driver, even though it wasn't. Not only that, was the driver, it wasn't just that he was drunk, it was that he had the person they used, it had 20.7% carbon monoxide in it, which meant that if that had been Henry Paul, he wouldn't have been able to walk at all, you know.
And, unless he was drunk and taking an SSRI Prozac drug, which incidentally was tested for, and they did find traces of that. It's one of the things that you can do. You can keep yourself on your feet if you're drinking. John Morgan, ladies and gentlemen, go Google him, Google the Diana Inquest, get his book, support his work, and support me as well by subscribing for $5 a month at TheEveningEastwoodShow.com.